Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Appellant versus James Robert Strahl, Appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Patricia Devaney, an Assistant Attorney General from Peer. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Philip Peterson. I'm sure this is different for you sitting in the appellee seat, Mr. Peterson. With him is Mr. A. Jason Rumpke. And Mr. Peterson, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
That's correct.
All right. Very well. Ms. Devaney, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. The state is here today to talk about the murder of Bill O'Hare at his home in rural Union County. Bill was brutally bludgeoned to death at his home in the late evening or early morning hours of May 17th, 18th of 1998. His phone lines were cut. Items of his property were stolen. His killer deadbolt locked the door to his home behind him, left in the victim's car, which was then abandoned at a garage in South Sioux City, just a couple blocks from where the defendant, James Strahl, lived at that time. The evidence discovered in the course of this investigation points to one person, and that is the defendant, who was the last person to be proven to be with the victim on the date that he was murdered. The very same day that he stands convicted of stealing and dumping his car, and that is a conviction which stands unchallenged today. So why are we here? We're here because about 5 months after the trial, the state discovered that it's one of its witnesses, a jailhouse informant, Aloysius Black Crow, committed perjury in an unrelated case when he admitted to fabricating recordings in that investigation. To date, there has been no evidence established whatsoever that the information that Black Crow testified about regarding Bill O'Hare's murder is not credible. And in fact, the evidence that I want to discuss with you here today proves that that information is credible. Now, this was the second time a new trial motion had been brought in this case to the trial court based on newly discovered impeachment evidence about this same witness. And the trial court in that first new trial motion found that it was cumulative impeachment evidence because at the defendant's trial, this witness's testimony was already severely impugned on cross-examination.
Is it the state's position that you have sufficient evidence with Mr. Black Crow's testimony aside to support this conviction, or do you need a credibility finding and add his testimony in to support the verdict?
Well, I'd like to discuss both of those. We believe that there is sufficient evidence even without Black Crow's testimony, but we also submit that you don't have to disregard Black Crow's testimony in its entirety because there are very good, solid reasons why his information is credible with regard to O'Hare's murder. Now, the areas that he was cross-examined on trial already include the fact that he has been convicted of 11 prior felonies. He named at least 8 of them on direct examination. He was serving a 90-year prison sentence. He admitted to having a substantial history of snitching. He admitted flat-out lying about an altercation with the same defendant in the Union County jail while this trial was pending. He ultimately agreed with defense counsel on cross-examination, and I think this is pretty close to a quote, if not a verbatim quote, that he was willing to lie to accomplish what he wanted to occur. So when you consider all of that, this is not a witness who anybody would believe a word of because of his credibility in general. If you're going to believe anything this man has to say, it's because what he has to say is corroborated, and there's no other explanation for how he would know this stuff if it had not come from Bill O'Hare's killer. Now, the trial court in that first new trial motion agreed with all that, said essentially the same thing in that hearing, and then went on to conclude, and I quote, "I think the state's right. To the extent that the jury accepted his testimony, they believed it, accepted it not because they believed he was a credible witness in general, but because his specific knowledge about the case, which was unexplained in any other way other than that he heard it from the defendant, certainly established the credibility of his testimony as it related to the conversations that he had with the defendant in this case." So the trial court did a reversal of that, essentially, in the second new trial motion. And the state, I would like to go through here today what we submit were some clear abuses of discretion in misapplying or ignoring critical facts in this case, and also in applying the correct legal standard for when new trials should be granted in the case of newly discovered evidence. Now, the first point that I wanted to make is that the trial court abused its discretion when it essentially ignored what I'll refer to as the elephant in the room, which is this mountain of corroborative evidence that existed verifying Blackrow's testimony about the O'Hare murder. The trial court barely even mentioned this fact when you read its memorandum opinion and simply drops a footnote, I think somewhere around page 8 or 9 of the opinion, making short shrift of what is actually an insurmountable hurdle for the defense in this case. The court did not cite at all to any of the suppression hearing transcript exhibits, which are all of that, those written documents in which Blackrow laid out the information that he got from the defendant in this case. And these were items that were not publicly available. And so the only other way he could have gotten them would have been through, the obvious way he got them is from the person who killed Bill O'Hare, and that's certainly what the evidence proves. Because even the defendant himself, at the time this information was obtained, hadn't even had access to the discovery in the case. So that would have been one other possibility, but he didn't have it. The defense entered into a stipulation with the state that was admitted at trial that set forth the timing of when the first meeting defense counsel had with the defendant after he got access to the discovery in the case. And there were already written statements in hand by the DCI agents from Blackrow regarding these details that were not publicly available. They weren't in the news. They weren't ever talked about in any kind of public hearing. And here are a few examples of those. The location of where the victim's body was found, that there were altercations in two different places in the home, upstairs and the victim's body is found downstairs, that the defendant and the victim had had beer, junk food, specifically naming potato chips, chocolate bars at the victim's home that day, matches up consistently with the evidence of what was found, what was purchased that day. It was a ball peen hammer, not the typical claw hammer type with the claw on the end. Instead, it was the flat-ended ball peen hammer.
You know, those are all physical facts. But what about, I mean, even with your argument about those kinds of corroborative detail, and even with the timing issues you present, what about the fact that he testified about premeditation, which is crucial, you know, to the conviction in this case?
Well,
That's not something that's really as critical with respect to the timing and the corroboration.
And that does appear to be that the factor the trial court hung its hat on, from my reading of the memorandum opinion. And when you look at the factors that this court has set out for how you determine whether or not an act is premeditated, and there were four of them that were referred to, you don't need Blackrow's testimony to establish any of those factors. Was there a
But just a minute, though.
Okay.
You may not need it, but that's not the question. Was it used by the jury for the conviction? I mean, technically, the elements, if you go to the law books, yeah, you may not need it. But that's not the question. Was it used by the jury to make a premeditation decision?
Well, you know, none of us can stand here now and say with any certainty what did the jury hang its hat on to decide whether or not there was premeditation. The most significant thing here, I think, is there is no evidence in this record to show provocation that would support a heat of passion or a manslaughter conviction. You take Black Crow completely out of the picture, and what do we have? We have a murder that happened with multiple blows in two different locations of a house. Okay, that to me is the most significant factor to consider when you decide whether this was a premeditated event. This wasn't one knock on the head with the hammer that killed somebody in the heat of passion. This is a knockdown, drag out, brutal assault in two different rooms of the house. And what is really key, I think, is if you look at the defendant's interview, okay, he was presented numerous different scenarios by the law enforcement officer interviewing him. Could this have been a sexual assault? Was this a fight that got out of hand? Was it due to drugs or alcohol or something like that going on in the house? And you know what his response was? He says, I'm not going to make up a story like that. Instead, he denies ever being at the house, denies ever knowing O'Hare. Well, we know those are flat-out lies based on the DNA and fingerprint evidence in the case. So what does that suggest to a jury? Suggests that he's lying, he's hiding his guilt. If he had an innocent reason for being there or some kind of reason that justified this killing, some kind of provocation, then he would have come with it. And he didn't. Instead, he said, I'm not going to make up a story like that. So when the jury looks at that interview tape and the manner and the brutal nature of this killing, what other conclusion can you draw but that this was a premeditated event? You take Black Crow completely out of the picture, and that's the evidence that they have to consider. So which one of the counts would you pick? You would pick the premeditation because there's nothing in the record to suggest provocation.
But isn't what happened here, when I read the trial court's decision, is he's trying to make it more of a level playing field, giving a new trial with now the information gathered afterwards from which the state realized that their key witness lies and makes up stories to convict people. And at least, isn't the trial court just saying, let's get a new trial so that new evidence about whether or not this person is credible is given to the defendant, and they have the ability to at least discredit this witness?
Well, this court...
This isn't saying you can't use him again in another trial, is it?
No, it's not. But this court has set the bar extremely high for granting of new trials in the cases of newly discovered evidence. And there's a reason that bar is set so high. You know, let's not forget there's another important player in this case, and that is a victim, the victim's family, who deserves some finality and some closure in this case. And we don't grant new trials unless there's an extremely good reason to do so, and it's an exceptionally rare and extraordinary case. And this is not such a case, because it is not some big bombshell piece of evidence that this witness is a liar. Everybody knew he was a liar. He admitted lying about the defendant in this case and fabricating evidence about an altercation of the defendant in this case. So it's not a scenario unlike some of the other cases cited in the briefs here, where you had a witness who was painted as a very credible person, someone who you could believe in general, that had no motive to lie or something to that effect, and then all of a sudden here comes this big surprise piece of evidence that, oh, I guess he did lie. And the other thing that you just simply cannot ignore, because these other cases that are referenced, when you refer to what the standard is or when some exceptions should be applied, they use terms such as the Taglia case, for example, that it should be a case that rested entirely on uncorroborated testimony of a single witness discovered after trial to be utterly unworthy of being believed. And the court should, in those cases, grant a new trial to prevent an innocent person from being convicted. Well, first of all, we have all kinds of corroboration from this witness. Second of all, there is absolutely no way you could say this case rested entirely upon Black Crow. Strahl was indicted before Black Crow even came into the picture. He never even met him. The case was indicted without him. How can it be said that it rests upon him? The state, we debated even whether to call him as a witness in this trial because of this baggage that he carried along with him after he pulled this stunt in the Union County Jail and lied about the defendant. But ultimately, after looking at the corroboration and the fact that it was not explained in any other way, we determined that the value of the information outweighed the baggage that he carried with him, and we put him on at trial. In closing argument, I got up and said to the jury, I went through all the evidence in the case first before I even talked about Black Crow. And when I brought him up, I said, you can consider this case without even considering the testimony of Black Crow. And why did I do that? Because he'd already been impugned significantly on cross-examination. How can it be said that the case rested upon him when I urged the jury that they could decide it without even considering his testimony?
But yet you also relied on him by referring to his testimony 93 times in final argument.
You know, I never went back and counted to verify whether that number was accurate, because I think it's the context of why I talked about him and what I was talking about him that matters. And the reason that he was mentioned so many times is because I sat down and went through a comparison of the details that he had and how it matched up with the physical evidence in the case. Now, I'd like to go back, if I could, to the point you were making about the premeditation and did the jury rely on Black Crow. Well, when you look at the factors, the four factors that have to be established to show premeditation, and then you look at what, if anything, Black Crow added to that, and the only thing with regard to the use of a lethal weapon, the manner, the nature of the killing, the defendant's actions before and after the murder, well, those things we can establish through the physical evidence of the case.
What about the trip, the thing about going to Sioux City and not him being upset about wanting a ride or something to Sioux City?
And that's what I was getting to. To me, that's the only really thing piece that he added here was the reason why he went up and started beating on this guy, which was he wouldn't give him a ride. According to what the defendant told him, he wouldn't give him a ride back to Sioux City. Well, the reason why he started hitting him is not an element of first-degree murder. We don't have to prove the reason or the motive. And, in fact, the evidence suggested another perfectly good reason or motive when we didn't need Black Crow at all for that, and that was burglary, to steal his property, steal the toolbox so he could go support his meth habit and sell it to his drug dealer. There's another perfectly good reason that Black Crow had nothing to do with. Now, you don't need, when you've got a killing that happens in this fashion, like I said, multiple blows, two different locations of the house, that's an act that requires some intent, premeditation. And you don't need the reason that, well, why did you do it? Because he wouldn't give me a ride home. That's the only thing of any significance that Black Crow added that was different, that wasn't already there.
You know, the trial judge in this case actually saw the trial. Listen to Black Crow, listen to everything. And, you know, the trial judge obviously had a big decision to make and thought about this a lot because of the change in position. And we afford a lot of deference, and in fact, we afford extra deference when a new trial is granted as opposed to denied.
That's true, and we fully appreciate the standard of review that we're dealing with here and would not be here asking you to reverse that decision if we did not believe that the trial court made some clear errors in arriving at that decision. And those clear errors had to do with ignoring some of the critical evidence in this case.
How can you say he ignored it, though? I mean, you mentioned the memorandum of opinion. He could have just ruled from the bench. You win, you lose. That's a sufficient ruling, and the fact that he doesn't come out with a 50-page legal masterpiece, what does that mean?
Well, he clearly put thought into the decision, and I'm certainly not here suggesting that he didn't. But let me go through a couple things, some specific observations that he said in the ruling, which we think are clearly erroneous. The court states that absent Black Crow's testimony, the state couldn't provide the time of death or the time Strahl was in the home and the relationship to the death. Now, that's an absolute inaccurate statement based on the evidence in this case. Now, I don't know if he just referred to the pathologist's testimony that the defendant pointed out in his brief, which referred to a date of death of like May 21st or something like that. Well, the pathologist at the time of the autopsy, that was before these critical bloody receipts in the bloody shirt pocket of the victim were examined, which show the last transactions are May 17th. I think the last is 9 or 10 o'clock in the evening, somewhere thereabouts on May 17th. The victim's car gets dumped in the early morning hours, found early the next morning at this garage. No report of the car being stolen. There's a newspaper with that weekend's date sitting right on the living room coffee table next to the open bag of potato chips with the defendant's fingerprints on it. The washcloth that has the defendant's pubic hairs and the victim's pubic hairs combined and the victim's blood is covering the sink in the bathroom drain. How does all of that evidence not establish the time of the victim's death and the time of when the defendant was there? We have a receipt from that day with items purchased on that receipt that match up dead on to the defendant's fingerprints in the house on those items, DNA in the house on those items. So that conclusion is clearly erroneous. We've got other statements in the court. When I talked about the premeditation issue, I've already gone through a lot of that, but the court's conclusion that there wasn't enough evidence of premeditation without Blackrow is clearly erroneous. The court, in its opinion, cites cases where there were different standards of materiality applied than the one that the court has to apply when considered newly discovered evidence. And I haven't got to that yet. That's pretty much laid out in my brief. But the court refers to cases where a witness actually committed perjury at the trial at hand. And we don't have that scenario right here.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Peterson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices. I'd like to open my argument with a quote from former dean of the law school, Dean Adams. When we were in torts class, he said to us, "If the law is against you, argue the facts." That's exactly what the state is doing in this case. They want to talk about the facts because the law is squarely against them. Judge Jensen, as Justice Zinner pointed out, sat through this entire trial and numerous hearings and a motion for a new trial before this one. And he had all that background. He heard Black Crow testify. He heard all the other witnesses testify, and he discusses the facts at length in his memorandum decision. And now the Attorney General's office would have you believe that he made grave errors in looking at the facts. I would like to point out that this jury was out for 21 hours. This wasn't a clear-cut case where the case was closed and the jury goes out and in 2 hours they come back with a conviction. There were facts on both sides of the issue. Obviously, there were facts for the defense as well, and we pointed some of them out in our brief. The residence was left alone for 2 days, unattended by law enforcement after they found the body. Black Crow testified that the defendant told him a tarp was used in transporting the body. They found a tarp. It was in the car. It was unused. They testified that Black Crow testified that he transported the toolbox in the vehicle, and yet with all the pictures of the vehicle and all of the junk in the vehicle, this toolbox was one of these big Craftsman red chest type toolboxes. There was not one area in the car where a place had been cleared for that toolbox to be placed. There were a lot of facts that didn't make sense in the defense's case. We had an individual come and testify who helped his brother move in and out of that house. Talked about the stairway and how steep it was, and there was no outside railing. The defendant weighed 120 pounds at the time of the alleged offense. The victim weighed 238 pounds. The state would have you believe that the victim walked down the stairs and didn't drop one drop of blood from the bedroom to the office downstairs. And yet there was so much blood in that upper room, so much blood on that bed, and it had pooled so much on the sheet that it ran over the side and onto the floor. Yet the state would have us believe that the victim walked downstairs because they have no explanation for how he got downstairs. And they have no explanation for how somebody that's 120 pounds can carry someone that's 238 pounds down those stairs, down those steep stairs without a railing, and not spill a drop of blood. The state's expert testified that there was no blood between the bedroom and the downstairs office. And yet the state stands here in front of you and says that the facts were so one-sided that without Black Crow, they could have gotten a conviction on first-degree murder. I submit to you that that's impossible. And as Justice Zinner pointed out, the point is not whether it is possible to get a conviction without Black Crow. The question is, did the jury rely upon his testimony? There's absolutely no question that they relied on his testimony. There was no evidence whatsoever tying the defendant to the alleged murder weapon. No fingerprints, no DNA. There were so many gaps in this case, as Judge Jensen pointed out, that had to be filled by Black Crow. And without Black Crow's testimony, there were gaps that could not be filled, and that, as Judge Jensen found, that they probably would not have returned a verdict of first-degree murder.
On the other hand, Mr. Peterson, as I understand it, Mr. Black Crow apparently admitted, or it was disclosed, that he had manufactured some evidence in this case with respect to this defendant. So how could the fact that he may have lied in some other case be more damaging to this jury than a disclosure to the jury that this guy was lying in this case about this defendant?
And what he lied about in this case was that he perpetrated an alleged altercation and cut his own shirt with the razor blade and said that the defendant did that. It had absolutely nothing to do with the case itself. But he did admit that he lied, and I appreciate the fact that the state indicates that I did a very credible job cross-examining him. But Justice Zinner, I propose on behalf of the defendant, there's a huge difference between admitting to a lie and committing perjury on two different instances. Lying before the court is a whole different thing than just lying to the jailer.
Is it really to a juror, though? I mean, here's a juror listening to a case and hearing that this witness manufactured evidence in this case, and then maybe hearing something that they may have lied about something in another case. Because I think all you're going to get in the other case is probably the fact of the perjury.
But again, he didn't lie about manufacturing evidence in this case, Justice Zinner. That was just, he was lying about an incident that occurred in the jail while they were both being held. And all he was trying to do was get away from the defendant and get into their own cells. And so he concocted a story. I think that is entirely different than committing perjury before the grand jury and committing perjury at a motion hearing under oath. And I think the jury would recognize the distinction. And as Judge Jensen has indicated, would find him totally without credence. Judge Jensen heard Black Crow's testimony, and his testimony was quite extensive. I don't think there's any doubt that the jury relied on Black Crow in making their decision. As is indicated in the prior argument, the state referred to him 93 times in the closing argument. How can you say, how can the state say that they didn't rely on him?
Did you attack his credibility in your closing argument?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
So the issue was joined.
Pardon?
The issue of his credibility was joined by both sides.
Yes. Yes, it was. But we did not have this crucial evidence that Judge Jensen found to be so important, and that was the commission of perjury. And had I been able to argue that to the jury, I think I could have wholly discredited him, and all of the references made to the evidence that he claimed that he obtained from the defendant, I think could have been ignored by the jury. The state acknowledges the significance of this perjury in that they have dismissed charges against David Licken as a result of the perjury. Now, in a corresponding case, another cold case, and Judge Jensen found the facts of the circumstances with Black Crow to be amazingly similar in the two cases. What did the state do in that case? They totally dismissed murder charges against David Licken. In this case, they're arguing that it doesn't matter. Now, how can you take that position? In one case, totally dismiss, and in the other case, say it doesn't matter. Doesn't make sense.
On the other hand, do you concede that I should never start a question with concede, because then you know. But, I mean, in this case, considering the timing of the disclosures and the physical evidence, it looks to me like a substantial amount of the evidence would not be impeached, no matter how big of a liar this guy is.
And I assume, Justice, because you're talking about he knew evidence that wouldn't have been known otherwise?
Right.
Is that what you're referring to?
But that plus the physical evidence.
Well, again, there are huge gaps in the physical evidence that only could be closed by Black Crow's testimony. I think, as Justice Myron Henry has pointed out, that I ought to be able to have the opportunity, as Judge Jensen said, to present all of the evidence to the jury. And that evidence includes perjury on behalf of Black Crow. And I think that the evidence is not as one-sided as the state would have this court believe. As I pointed out in the brief, or as Mr. Rumsa pointed out since he wrote the brief, there are a lot of facts that do not point to the guilt of the defendants. But what I would like to talk about is the standard that the state has in this case. As the Chief Justice pointed out, it's not usual for me to have the law on my side in being a criminal defense attorney. Usually I'm fighting the burden. In this case, the state is fighting the burden, and how big is that burden? The burden is a clear abuse of discretion. I don't think in her argument that she has shown this court that there's been a clear abuse of discretion. The judge extensively discussed the facts. He sat in the courtroom from August 7th till August 22nd and listened to the facts and the argument of counsel. Who has a better understanding of the facts and the influence that Black Crow had upon that trial and on the jury than Judge Jensen? And I don't think anywhere near enough valid argument has been presented to this court to just do away with Judge Jensen's memorandum opinion, which took 12 pages of single-spaced writing for him to discuss the facts and to discuss the law as it applied in this case. the state has a huge burden. The test is, as set by this course, only if no legal mind could reasonably have reached such a conclusion are we going to override Judge Jensen's decision. When you're considering that, I want you to remember that it took this jury 21 hours to make a decision. And at that time, they were relying, and the state was relying, on Black Crow for this conviction. Had the jury known that Black Crow had committed perjury in a similar case, and that those charges were dismissed against that defendant, we can only imagine what the impact would have been upon the jury and their ability to sort through the facts with that new knowledge. My client is clearly entitled to another shot in the trial court level. This court has said, and the United States Supreme Court has said, that motions for new trials should only be granted when it's in the clear interest of justice. Is this court going to go on record as saying that in this extraordinary circumstances, as Judge Jensen found this to be the unusual, extraordinary case, that when something as clear as perjury has been committed by one of the state's chief witnesses, and it's later discovered, and the charges in that perjured case are dismissed, that the jury is not entitled to that information? That's what the state would have you decide today. And I don't think that's proper. I don't think that that's in the interest of justice. My client is entitled to a new trial. You know, over the weekend, and it was the Memorial Day weekend, as you well know, and I had an opportunity to spend a little time out at my farm and think about this case, and had an opportunity to turn on the television and see movies like The Longest Day, such things. And I thought about, what are those guys fighting for? What are they doing there? Storming the beaches of Omaha and Normandy, Utah. What are they doing? Running out in harm's way? Machine gun nests, have them pinned down? Thousands of them killed? What was that all about? My friends, it was about in the interests of justice. That was so that the world would remain free. And what are the young people in our country now doing over in Afghanistan, in Iraq? What are they doing there? Are they just riding around in personnel carriers, trying to keep the local peace? Are they just a police force? No. What they're there for is to try to give those people justice. And that's what we're doing here today, in a different sense. But we're doing the same thing. We are here in the interest of justice. My client, even though he sits in the penitentiary today, is just as much entitled to a fair trial as anyone in this room. If we are accused of somebody, of something, we are entitled to a fair trial. And so is he. And my friends, the state today would deny my client the fair trial. And everything that we stand for and everything that this country stands for would be thrown away. I think that this man is entitled to his day in court when the scales are even. Not when the scales are like this, because one of the main witnesses for the state has committed perjury. And it's unknown to the defense or the state at that time. But the scale should be even. And my client is entitled to his day in court with a fair trial. That's all we're asking for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Ms. Devaney, you have 10 minutes.
Well, the defendant got a fair trial, and he did get his day in court. And when the defendant said, all the state wants to talk about are the facts and rather than the law, I would like to talk about the law. I didn't get to it. But the facts that I set forth are clearly on the side of not granting a new trial in this case. But with regard to the law, this court has never, as far as I could find, ordered or granted a new trial on the basis, solely on the basis of impeachment evidence. That is one of the factors set out in the Geem test, and we haven't talked about that. But there, along with South Dakota, there are many other cases and jurisdictions where courts continually adhere to that rule that impeachment evidence should not be the basis for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence. Now, excuse me. There is no concern here that the jury convicted an innocent man. The judge did not order a new trial in the grand theft conviction. So as of today, if we retry this case, he stands convicted of stealing this guy's car on the same day that he's bludgeoned to death, on the same day he coincidentally happens to be in the house based on the items of evidence and the receipts that prove he was there that day. So if we're talking about a new trial, we're going to have essentially the exact same trial, but with the exception that that's going to open the door if he makes a charge of recent fabrication, I believe, to all of these exhibits that were admitted at the suppression hearing transcript, his written documentation, which corroborates and shows that he wouldn't have had any other way of knowing this information, with one additional lie that he told in an unrelated case. Now, with regard to that Lincoln case, I need to make this very clear as well. This case can clearly be distinguished from the Lincoln case. The Lincoln case was a 30-year-old case that had no crime scene, had no physical evidence. There was no physical evidence to corroborate Blackrow in that case. His corroboration was the recordings. When you lose the recordings, then your significant piece of evidence is gone, and that's why that case had to be dismissed. You contrast that, and that case was indicted based on Blackrow's testimony. Contrast that to Strahl, a case that was indicted before Blackrow ever came into the picture. And back to the point on the law. The law is on the state side in this case. If you read all of those cases that are cited in the standard for when you grant a new trial, even when it is based on the impeachment evidence of a witness, when they're looking at should that rare circumstance apply or exception apply, they talk about, use words like entirely resting upon, if this were the only witness that connected the defendant to the crime, that sort of stuff. That's the kind of scenario where the court could conceivably consider that. That is not this case. He talks about huge gaps in the evidence. There aren't huge gaps in the state's evidence in this case. And if you read my closing argument, you will see I did not marry the state's case to Blackrow's version of what happened here. In fact, the evidence suggested other possible versions, and the point is they all support first-degree murder. The phone lines being cut and the blood spatter in the victim's office clearly support an argument that he's trying to call for help, and this guy comes in and whacks him multiple times with a hammer and kills him. That is first-degree murder. And that is something that Blackrow's testimony wasn't needed for at all. When you look at the court's reasoning with regard to the grand theft conviction, that illustrates its flawed reasoning on this first-degree murder conviction grant of a new trial, because how can you distinguish the two? The evidence of the grand theft without Blackrow's testimony is arguably just as circumstantial as the murder case, yet the court had no trouble finding that the new evidence wouldn't have produced a different verdict with regard to that charge. Now, the bottom line here, you know, I don't know what, if any, weight. I can't stand here and tell you what weight the jury, if any, played on Blackrow's testimony in this trial. But there was a comment reported, which is in the trial transcript. I don't know if you've seen that. But one of the jurors, after Black Rose's testimony, reported that a juror said he wouldn't believe a word, anything that guy had to say. It was something to that effect. That's in the trial transcript. Yet that juror, we know, voted to convict him for the defendant for first-degree murder. So that's what we're dealing with here. If any of them did believe Black Rose, they didn't believe him because he's a credible person. He's an admitted liar, a liar who lied about the defendant. They believed him because of the fact that what he had to say was corroborated. And to date, even yet today, the defense has no response to that. That's a hurdle they can't overcome. And when you look at the cases that are out there where exceptions to the impeachment rule for granting new trials and newly discovered evidence are looked at, that's another distinction that is made, whether or not the testimony was somehow otherwise corroborated. And we have that in this case. You simply cannot ignore that. You know, in with regard to those suppression hearing exhibits, and that's something I haven't fully gotten into. But if there was a charge made in a new trial was had with regard to what would it look like if we tried the case? There is prior case law that you have issued that says you have to look at what would be done if this new evidence were there or if it were available. Well, once you start looking at, and I don't know if you've had the chance to do that, once you start looking at that written documentation, you know, if you weren't convinced already, then looking at that would certainly take you over that hurdle because it's all there. It's documented and it's dated before, and it was in DCI's hands before the defendant even had access to discovery. And if you look at the stipulation that the defendant entered into, that is also extremely significant in what impact, if any, this new information would have when you're looking at a retrial. It's simply a waste of judicial resources. It's not fair to the victims, the victims' family, who also deserve justice. And what Mr. Peterson talked about, what people have fought for, don't forget that there are two sides to this. And if there is no real concern here that an innocent man has been convicted, then a new trial is not warranted. And when you look carefully at the trial court's decision, the clear implication to me, the trial court makes a statement. The state may have achieved a conviction without Black Rose testimony. Now, that in itself contradicts the language in the case law, like the Taglia case that was cited. If the state may have obtained a conviction without Black Rose testimony, then how can you say the case rested entirely upon his testimony? And then the court goes on to say something to the effect, but in the court's opinion, it probably wouldn't have been first-degree murder, which suggests to me the court may have concluded, well, gee, they would have convicted him of something, but maybe it would have been a lesser-included offense. Well, that's not the standard for granting a new trial. The standard for your new trial, for granting a new trial with newly discovered evidence, is he probably would have been acquitted.
Of all charges or only the charge he was convicted of?
Well, you know, when you start looking at, gee, maybe was there a possibility of a lesser occluding offense here, and the court says things like, well, maybe there were some other scenarios present. That, in effect, I submit, is applying what is more akin to a possibility standard rather than a probability standard.
Was the jury in this case given the option of giving a lesser included offense?
They were charged in the alternative. And as I went through earlier, there really was no evidence of any kind of provocation or heat of passion in this case that would have supported a manslaughter conviction, even without Black Rose testimony. And I think the defendant's interview itself is a critical piece of evidence for you to consider when you look at whether or not that would have been a probability even with the new evidence that's been submitted in this case. So as I said, you know, Both the facts and the law in this case simply do not support the grant of a retrial. The defendant had a fair trial. He had his fair day in court, and we would ask that you overturn the trial court's decision on this first, granting a new trial on this first-degree murder conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Devaney. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.